Okay, folks, we might just kick off. So in the absence of Jonathan Curtis, the Assistant Secretary of Research Branch, who is unfortunately away sick, I'm doing the honours today and introducing our distinguished speaker. And before I do, I'd like to also acknowledge the Academy of Science. We have here Chris Happily from the Academy, who've helped us to pick some experts and get this lecture and next week's one up and running. And a quick ad for Science Week. National Science Week is on now, just saying. So, today we have Dr. Rob Hansen, who is a very distinguished person in the area he's going to be talking about, which is why we have him. He's at the ANU's AAA Institute, as it's called, which is Autonomy, Agency and Assurance. But cool kids call it 3A, I believe. He's working there, but he also has a foot in CSIRO, at the Data 61 part of CSIRO. So he's sort of in both organisations, as I understand. CSIRO pay him, and ANU is where he goes and spends his days. So he's here to tell us about blockchain. If you don't know what blockchain is, don't worry. You will find out. If like me, you've heard of it for a number of years, but you're not really sure of it and its implications, you'll also find out, because this will take us into not only what it is, but also some of its implications, and some of those are really quite surprising. Believe me, I had a sneak peek at the talk. So it's going to be good. Without further ado, Dr. Rob Hansen. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot. I need to disappoint you off the bat. I'm not a doctor. I do have two master's degrees, but yes, I do work at Data 61 and at CSIRO. So today what we're going to do is I'm going to take you for about 45 minutes through a presentation. It's a non-technical presentation. We're going to talk about what this thing is called blockchain. We'll talk about some of its uses. We'll talk about some of the reasons why you wouldn't want to use it. And then we get to the end. I've got a tool that will help you visualize what this thing is. A lot of people talk about it, but at the end, we've got a tool from Data 61 that can talk you through or show you what this thing actually looks like, and then we'll move into Q&A. So if we're all good with that, let's get cracking. So before I actually start, I need to acknowledge that the original custodians of this country and pay my respects to the Ngunnawal people and their leaders past and present. So, Data 61, if you haven't heard, we're an innovation unit, part of CSIRO. We've been around now for just over 2 years. If you hadn't heard of CSIRO, if you hadn't heard of CSIRO, we invented Wi-Fi. You're welcome. So I'm also, as mentioned, at the 3A Institute. So we're looking at future evolving technology. So AI, blockchain is part of it, but things like algorithms, data. What is this technology? What does it mean when it starts to do its own thing? So when it's got autonomy, when it's got agency, and therefore, what do we need to think about when it comes to assurance? How do we make sure that this thing is put in ethically? How do we make sure that privacy is considered? Our values, which are either enshrined in law or culturally, how are they reflected in this technology? And they shift over time. So if we build something today, how do we make sure that it does what we need to do in the future? So that's what I spend the most of my days doing. But before I get too much further, I need to give you a disclaimer. Please don't go out and buy any Bitcoin and said Rob told me to, because I did not. So I'm here because I wrote this report. So about a year ago, we published this report on blockchain. It was NISA funded through CSIRO. There were two reports. I wrote the non-technical one that said, hey, here's this technology. What does that mean in relation to our regulatory environment, to our industries? Where could we go with this sort of thing? So mine was future looking, more in the layperson's language. And there was a sister report that came out as well, and that was more technically grounded in the current application of the technology as it stands. And we'll talk about where that's going during the presentation. So why are we here? We're here because lots of people are very excited about this technology, and we believe that it could do really great things. So this is the head of the Bank of England, and he's saying blockchain, not just by itself, but with a bunch of other technologies, could really herald the start of the fourth industrial revolution. So what is the fourth industrial revolution? What we're talking about is different to most of the other industrial revolutions, because we've usually gone, oh, we had something there. The big thing occurred, and now let's go back and have a look at what that actually meant. This time around, we're looking forward, and we're going, there's a lot of data coming down the pipe. There's a lot of data, and that is being used by things called cyber-physical systems. These things are just computer applications, they're robotics, they're having an impact on the real world. And so the language that we use is very much in the same way that steam was driving the steam engines, and that really changed our world when it came to the first industrial revolution. We had things like time zones that sprang out of the fact that we now had trains running across the country and need to synchronize ourselves. In a similar sort of way, we've got all this data, and it's starting to develop into systems, and we need to think about what paradigm shift that is causing to our society. So blockchain is part of that conversation. So really, at the heart of it, what are we talking about? We're talking about the fact that blockchain can give us trust, both in data and devices, that we didn't have before. We're talking about integrity. So there's three elements to information security: confidentiality, integrity, and availability. You need to get that balance right. Blockchain really sits at the heart of that around the integrity side of things. So I'm going to give you the very simple overview as to what this blockchain stuff is. I've got a little metaphor, and it will sort of help you conceptually get your mind around what this is. So if we think about spreadsheets, I hate spreadsheets. I used to be in the corporate world. I used to do enterprise risk management, and I used to have to go out and get all the risks and bring them together and try and, you know, cobble them all together, get a dashboard view, send that up to the executive and get them to agree, yes, no, this is our risk picture. And I used to say, could I have an information system for that, please? Can I get this all this information together, synthesize it, and put it to a nice pretty report? And I was told repeatedly in many different organizations, can't you just use spreadsheets? And spreadsheets aren't meant for text, but I used to use them. And so I get all this information that would come into me, but I didn't know if that was the true story at the end of the day. So had that executive sent me all the information, had they been the person that had updated that information? Do I have the current state? What's out there on thumb drives and laptops and network shares that I haven't seen? So what's going on with all this information? So it was a big challenge. So let's extend that metaphor slightly. Let's now talk about blockchain, and it's really two things. It's a block, and it's a chain. So let's talk about the block bit to start with. Spreadsheets, right? Everyone knows a spreadsheet. Let's say that I have a spreadsheet, and it's formatted in a particular way for a transaction. So all the columns say particular things, like, you know, who I am, and what date it is, and what I'm doing. And you have the same sort of thing. So we fill out our transactions. And I say, I'm doing this particular thing, and it records the date, the time, and who I am, all that sort of stuff. Once I've put my transaction in, so that row, once that row's gone in, goes up to the cloud. You do the same thing. You're all doing transactions. They go up to the cloud as well. What happens is, at a certain point in time, and we'll talk about this, you might have heard of miners and those sorts of things, at a certain point in time, someone comes and they grab all the transactions which are in that cloud. They put them into one spreadsheet, so all the transactions are there. They lock that spreadsheet using some special maths. So we have this particular spreadsheet, it's been locked, it's got all those transactions at that particular point in time. That's our block. So it's our locked spreadsheet, it's our block. We then use some special maths to link that block to the next block. So as we make another block, we fill out the transactions and we stick it in there. That's locked as well, and that is locked to this previous block as well. So we have this chain of records. It's not immutable. People often say that it is. It's tamper evident. But essentially, we have this giant audit trail. So unlike a database, which you can go into and you can update, modify, and delete, this is a permanent record, kind of written in stone, and it just keeps getting bigger. So we've got integrity. It's a novel application of information systems. With computers, you can change things, you can do whatever you want, but in this circumstance, you can't. And so it's all there. And so we go, if we write something into this, then we can be pretty sure, we can trust the fact that it hasn't been changed. And that is the key difference. Now, another thing that makes this slightly different as well is that rather than there being one database, all the people involved in the blockchain get a copy of that new block as it gets made, and they add it to their own ledger. So they've all got a copy of this as well. So we've all got a copy, it's all the same, and it can't be changed. And that is the fundamental difference between this technology and databases. And people starting to look at this and go, that's really interesting. What can we do with that? So the first use case was around Bitcoin. So digital currencies have been around for a little while. And the challenge with digital currencies are that they are zeros and ones. So what's to stop me giving you a coin and then copying and pasting those zeros and ones and giving them to you and to you? I can be a billionaire. It's really easy. So there was all these reconciliation processes that people had to go through, but it was really challenging. So what happened was, around the time of the GFC, particularly when people weren't trusting the banks and financial institutions, someone went, if I use this blockchain technology, that concept that I related to just a moment ago, what I can do is I can have those transactions written down, and we can see what's going on. So if I have a coin, you can see in the ledger, yep, that coin belongs to Rob. If I spend it, you can see that I don't have it anymore, and you can see exactly where it is. So it's an anti-fraud mechanism. So that was the fundamental use of it back when it all started. Now, in recent years, several billion dollars have been spent on blockchain development. Not cryptocurrency, blockchain. The underlying technology, because it's been around for a while and people have using it, people have looked at it and gone, that's really interesting. How else can we use that? So this graph only goes up to 2016. It's kind of hard at the moment to peel away the vaporware from what's actually being spent out there, but we know that lots of money is being spent. So this is a presentation about an emerging technology. There aren't any standards just yet. Australia is leading the world on this. I was on the steering committee that set up the secretariat, and now Australia is the secretariat for the international standards for blockchain, and we're doing things around smart contracts and all sorts of things in that space, but they don't exist just yet. There aren't standards. All this money being spent means that there is the technology and the people that are currently being built to use this technology, but it's a bit of the Wild West at the moment. We'll talk about some of that in just a second. So one of the other challenges around cryptocurrency, and I won't spend too long on this, but I will touch on it during this presentation, is the fact that someone's taken the word crypto and the word currency and they've smashed it together, and that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a currency, right? So there are three factors, as you would know, to being a currency, right? So it's fungible, it's a store of value, and it's a mechanism of trading and exchange. As you can see, the volatility of this cryptocurrency, which is very similar to lots of other cryptocurrencies, is extremely high. So if I give you a coin today to buy something from you, would you want to accept it from me if tomorrow it could be worth $10,000 less? Do I want to give it to you if tomorrow it could be worth $10,000 more? It's not really acting like a currency. So, I will emphasize the point, just underscore it with a few slides. So here's an article out of the New York Times saying, people aren't really using it like a currency. They're using it, but they're not necessarily using it as we would expect or people would like them to. Lots of people are interested in it, but not really many people are actually using it as well. And some people are speculating, and it's not necessarily turning out in their favour. So I'll leave that there, and I'll move on. Use cases. So this is a hard one, because it's like, what would you use a database for? Lots of stuff. What would you use a blockchain for? Whatever you got. So there are upsides and downsides to using blockchain. We'll walk through that through the rest of the presentation. But a lot of people, and I'll skip straight to the bottom dot point there, think blockchain, that's all about disintermediation. It's all about cutting out the middleman. Why do I need the bank anymore when I can transact peer-to-peer from myself to someone else? Well, if you do that, you lose the regulatory environment. So, for example, if I have all my money sitting in a wallet and the wallet is hacked, then I lose all my money. Who do I go to get my money back? At the moment, banks get hit all the time, but they cover that, so I keep my money in the bank. So whilst there might be a reduction of friction in the system, going peer-to-peer, say for remittance, and I don't have to use all the actors in the middle, there is a downside to that type of thing as well. So people often say, it's all about disintermediation. Actually, where we're seeing the benefits are at the moment are from the top couple, right? So integrity, provenance, transparency, those sorts of spaces. It's a fantastic anti-fraud tool. We'll walk through some of those examples. So, one of the ones which is interesting and people aren't necessarily thinking too much about is the fact that in, this is 2015, the OECD came out and they said, wow, all those IoT devices out there, if you've seen projections of how many there will be, there's a huge curve where there'll be billions of devices because they're becoming cheaper and faster and more connected. So we'll use them for all this sort of stuff. So that's great. The problem is you need to be able to trust them. If you can't trust them, then we're in a world of hurt. The OECD said, oh, it will be an internet of trust because of all these internet of things, but we need mechanisms to be able to give us that integrity with these devices. And so blockchain might help us there. So some of the places the blockchain is being used for provenance in these types of ways, there's a company called T-Provenance, which is a bit of a startup, and there's lots of proofs of concept out there at the moment. That's sort of the challenge at the moment. There's lots of people saying they're doing things, and whether or not they are or they are not is hard sometimes to discern. And then sometimes when they do crack onto a vein of gold and they go, this is fantastic, sometimes things go a bit quiet, so it's a bit hard to know what's going on whilst they do further commercialization and further research in that space. But T-Provenance is an area that is collaborating with Data61, and what they're doing is they're looking at mangoes. They're actually using some of our tech as well to look at the quality of the mangoes. So we've got some lenses that can look at a mango and go, right, that's ripe or it's not ripe, because we've got some special lenses and those sorts of things. So we're collecting that data, as mangoes go from farmer to supermarket, and we can record the state that it is during that transaction, or during that supply chain. And so what we can do is we can say, oh, okay, maybe we need further refrigeration here, or when this person picked up this lot of goods, it was fine at that point, or it wasn't fine at that point. And that was what the OECD was saying. They were saying, if we have all these Internet of Devices, all these Internet of Things around the place, if there's consignment that goes away from Australia offshore, what we can do is we can track exactly where it is, and then we can reduce disputes. And we can say, right, the humidity was fine, or these were the people that accessed the container, or the weight never changed, and so everybody can have visibility as to what happened with that good as it travelled, and so there should be less disputes in that space. Another poster child is AgriDigital. AgriDigital is a fantastic story because it is all about harms at the farm. So what happens with wheat is a farmer sells the wheat. There's usually an intermediary, a middleman. They then take the wheat and then they get the bank to buy the wheat from them. So that's a chain that happens. Sometimes the intermediary doesn't have the funds. So they take the wheat, they don't pay the farmer, they go to the bank and the bank says, we don't want that wheat, for whatever reason. By that time, the wheat is now in a silo and it's commingled. So they can't get the wheat back. So there's lots of financial hardship, suicides and problems at the farm. So AgriDigital come from some farmers in that space. They're doing a lot more than this now, but they started off going, right, what we should do is we should make sure that we capture all that information. So when the quality sensors go into the wheat, they capture the humidity, they capture the weigh stations, how heavy it is, they've got all that data. And then what they do is they also capture whether or not the intermediary can pay for the wheat. And if they can, they facilitate transfer of title. If they don't, they say, no, that's not going to happen. So it's a fantastic story about what's happening in that space. But like I said, they are starting to move into much more spaces, much more different spaces about that now. So there's potential here for blockchain to really change the way that we start to structure organisations, organise our value chains, and the types of transactions that we undertake. Now, it's not just blockchain alone. There's a whole bunch of other cyber physical systems in this space. But really, when we start to think about this, there is a lot of potential here for this technology. But like I said, I'm not for or against blockchain. I'm just a researcher, and I'm quite interested in what's happening in this space. And it's my job to come along and go, but what about? Have you thought about? And so we're about to move into some of those sorts of questions now. Trust. So everyone goes on about how blockchain is a machine about trust. So the challenge here is that when it started as Bitcoin, it was all about a dematerialized asset or a digitized asset, series of zeros and ones on that ledger. And so all that would happen is these series of zeros and ones would move from being assigned to this person to being assigned to that person. When we start to talk about these use cases, and we'll talk about a few more in a moment, we start to talk about the real world. And if we're talking about the real world, it's messy. And there's a whole bunch of other things that are going on. So trust is contextual. And when you think about a blockchain, you need to think about what that blockchain is giving to you and what is it doing to you, for you, and what's not doing as well. So if we're talking about a real world process, how do we have integrity in that process? How can we be sure that the real world is actually being reflected onto our blockchain? Once it's on the blockchain, great, doesn't change. But how do we make sure that what's actually happening out there is reflected onto it? And so we need to think through those steps as we start to apply blockchain. Blockchain is really hyped at the moment. People are very interested in it. It's a useful conversation to have, even if people don't go down that path, because the types of conversations I have and other people in this space is they start to reimagine their information systems. They start to think about how they can use them. How else can we get trust and integrity? What can we do both in terms of technology, but also in our real-world process to actually make it a bit better as well? So it's a useful conversation that we're having. So some of the challenges we're having at the moment. Well, there is some research going into this to talk about what we can do, but the problem is, as I mentioned, the blockchain just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. When this all started, it was a bit of a utopian dream with the GFC, and they're like, we can do our own thing, we don't need banks and infrastructure, let's just use this. And of course, the blockchain was very small, everybody could have a copy of it, everybody was mining it and doing things, and we'll talk about that in a second. Challenge is, at the moment, it's approaching 200 gig, so that's not necessarily something you can store in your smartphone anymore, and you can interrogate yourself. So we started to become reliant upon the miners and the other people that are processing the blocks in the system to make sure that the system's actually healthy and doing the right sorts of things. So originally when we're saying it's a free-for-all, everybody can get involved, it's fantastic, now we're actually starting to find, because of the age of the system, that it's actually changing in its dynamics. So it's something that we need to think about. When you start to use these sorts of technologies, it's not a replacement for a database. You don't want to throw a lot of data into this thing. It's easy to read these things, it's harder to write to them, and you don't want to throw too much stuff onto them. So we can talk about that too in Q&A if you'd be interested. There's some more challenges. I mentioned security at the beginning. People often go, blockchain is secure. And they're saying that because they're talking about the trust in the integrity of the fact that I put something here and now it's really hard to change that. And if you do change it, well, we can kind of tell. It's not necessarily secure in terms of keeping your information private. Now, if you do encrypt information and you store it on a blockchain, there's a couple of challenges there. One of the challenges is the fact that you may be familiar with legacy systems. Someone builds something, there's a bit of a prototype. People promise they're going to do all this sort of maintenance and system development, and maybe not really. And then this thing hangs around for 5, 10, 15, 30 years. And hasn't really been changed. And if you throw something onto a blockchain today, and let's say you've gone, I'm going to throw some encryption on that, so only people who are allowed to see it can see that. Well, that might be good if you've put on the current standard of encryption today. A lot of people don't. If you put that on, and then you go, okay, everyone gets a copy. There are different types of blockchains. Sometimes it's a public one, everyone gets a copy. Sometimes it's permissioned, which is a bit of a gray area. And sometimes people get access to it and they don't. We can talk about that later too. But whoever gets access to this, down the track, if computers get really fast and or someone really smart comes along and goes, ah, well, that encryption mechanism you use there, I've got a way of making that half as strong, or I can defeat that, so now it's trivial to defeat. The controls you're putting in place now may not stand up into the future to make sure that that information is private. So we need to think about that. We also need to think too, people say, oh, well, if you don't want to put too much information into this blockchain because it's working really quickly, I'll just put some metadata there. Well, there's challenges with metadata. There's a whole bunch of things you're probably aware of. If a data set gets out there and another one comes along, you can put the two of them together and you can start to re-identify information and find things like that. But you also need to think about that encryption as well. And as this chart shows, if you can see it, we're talking, this is Moore's Law. Computers are getting pretty fast, pretty quick. And we might have a step change situation where we get quantum computing. And what does that mean? Well, NIST, which is the standards body over in America, and CIA have come out and they've worked out a way that blockchain could continue in that world, because when you make one of those blocks, you actually have to solve a cryptographic problem using the proof of work mechanism. And I've probably gone too fast for that, but we'll get to that in a moment. So we could potentially find ourselves in situations where we have a bit of a disruptive break with blockchain coming up, if quantum becomes a thing. And there might be a challenge with quantum has and have nots, and we'll talk about that too. So, this one's an interesting one. Leads down from where we were just a moment ago. What happens if you're writing something to a blockchain and you put something classified on there and you can't really take it off? Or if it's something which is embarrassing and now it's FOIable? Or it's illegal? I work with a bunch of lawyers in this space, and they do proof of concepts all the time, and they will not use public blockchains for these reasons. There is questionable stuff on several blockchains out there, if not illegal, but I'm a lawyer, so don't take my advice for it. And the question is, if you have a copy of that on your computer, is that illegal? So we need to think these things through, and generally they're governance questions at the end of the day. So if you can modify your blockchain, is it a blockchain? People are working on this and they're going, right, you can put it in, but you know, to give you peace of mind, we'll give you some technology which enables us to redact what was on the blockchain, just like you redacted classified information with a big black pen. We can all go, right, that never happened. Well, you start to lose trust in the system if you do that. If you get down the track and you have multiple people who were engaged with that particular decision leaving, and you get new people coming in, they go, well, hang on, what did that represent? Does that relate to my asset these days? Does that have a material impact on this thing over here? We can't tell. So really, if you've got a blockchain and you're going to use it, you probably don't want to be able to change it, but you probably want to have a conversation about how you deal with that situation.
So, for example, often with databases, a judge will say for a contract, that transaction was unconscionable or shouldn't happen. For whatever reason, roll it back. And so you can, on your database, you go, right, we're going to change that back, that never happened. If that's now happened on a blockchain, are your processes set up to go, oh, that was a whoops, what do we do now? So, for example, with lands titles organizations, you can have an administrative slip up right now, and you can have a transfer of title, and it shouldn't have happened, but it's gone. If you don't think about it when you're putting together these sorts of systems, you can find yourself in situations where you can do that unintentionally. So that brings me to my final 3 points. So really, because it's a novel application of information systems, we're talking about cross-domain expertise, which is required. I've spoken with lots of technologists, and like I said, there are not many guidelines, there aren't any standards just yet, it's a fairly new space, but people are very keen to talk about how they can use this technology, but they don't often know what the implications of that are. So I strongly suggest that everyone gets involved in the conversation. I'll be talking with some auditors this afternoon, and I'll be saying, you guys need to be part of this as well. I often talk with lawyers, and I say, you need to be in there too. It's not that you need to understand the underpinning technology, and if you have questions about that, we can go into that as well later on. In Q&A, but you need to understand the implications and you need to be able to have that conversation with the technologists and be involved in the design of these systems because there can be lots of problems that come up. So there's also a challenge with the amount of data which is about to be out there. So we need to get integrity from this data if we're going to be able to make value out of it. And normally I have a slide, I'm surprised I must have missed it, that basically goes along from 2005 to 2015. So it goes along in a sort of straight line like this. And it's a chart of the amount of information that we have on the internet. So sum total of human knowledge expressed in what's been digitized. And you can see this great thing that's growing. And then I normally go, well, how much taller do you think that will be if I project that out from 2015 to 2025? People say, oh, a little bit more on that straight line. Well, if it's been doubling every 12 to 18 months, line is the fact that on a screen like this, I would need about 75 more meters to show you how much more data there is. So people then go, well, the NBN's not that great. I can only download so much Game of Thrones. What are you talking about? I go, it's all those devices I was telling you about. They're all going to be out there, and they're not necessarily going to be talking to you, they're going to be talking to each other and doing a whole bunch of other stuff. And to capture the value out of that and to actually make sure that we can harness that and do good things, we need to find mechanisms that do that, and blockchain could be part of that story. So the last thing is around privacy. So I spoke to you about that in a bit of depth. If you're going to put stuff, information, on these blockchains, you really need to think about how you can protect that. Who's going to get access to this? What happens if you're in a consortia, there's a bunch of players, and it's sort of a permissioned private blockchain, so you're like, it's right, it's not public, it's controlled, but then we have a machinery of government, or someone leaves the consortia because they're an industry player or whatever else, and they still need access, often from a regulatory or legislative purpose, to that information. How do you control that? What do you do with these sorts of things, particularly if the controls that you're putting in place to protect this data literally stay with the data and they age in place and you have no further control over that? So we need to think through, there's lots of novel things happening in this space. So right now, what I'm going to try and do is bring up a visualizer that will demonstrate to you how this technology sort of works. And then what we'll do is we'll move into some Q&A. So are you here, Alex? No? I'll try and bring up the... There we go. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. So this is a blockchain visualizer that Data61 has come up with, and it's the Ethereum blockchain. So this is happening in real time. One of the reasons that I don't show you Bitcoin is because the Bitcoin block gets generated every 10 minutes. That's another reason why I don't believe Bitcoin is going to take over the world, because if it takes every 10 minutes for you to actually get your transaction up there, and in a second we'll talk about the fact that it takes a while for you to actually trust the fact that your transaction is in there, so you have to wait usually about 6 blocks, and you're not sure if you're going to get onto the next block or not, because as you can see, there's quite a large pool there. There's about 11,000 transactions sitting in the pool waiting to go onto the next block. You're never sure when you're going to get on, so you're not going to tap and go with Bitcoin anytime soon. So here's Ethereum. Every couple of seconds, there's a new block. So I was talking to you before about the transactions that are formatted into that spreadsheet. These are all those transactions that are sitting in that cloud, primarily being used for ICOs, or initial coin offerings, and smart contracts and those sorts of things. Occasionally, people are buying things. And what happens is, in this method, every now and then, somebody makes a Sudoku. So what they're doing is they are putting some work into the system to say, I've solved the puzzle, and it's a race. So if we let whoever just come along and slap some transactions together, they could game the system. They could say who gets to be the next transaction, or they could also start to put fraudulent transactions into the system as well. To keep everyone honest, we put them into a race. We go, right, you have to solve the problem. It's hard to do, but once you do it, everybody can see what that is. So it's like Sudoku. And so everyone's grinding away, trying to do these Sudokus, and then every now and then somebody wins, and when they go, yep, in it goes, that's the next block on the system. So there's a few other things going on here. One of them is the fact that you'll see the red blocks that are in this chain as well. They're called uncles. They didn't quite make it. So blockchain is generally a peer-to-peer system. So it's a whole bunch of nodes out there, and there can be someone over here that wins the Sudoku and gets a block together, and there can be someone over here at the same time who wins the Sudoku and gets a block. And so they start to tell their friends who tell their friends and on like this, and at some point they go, oh, there's two blocks. So it's forked. Essentially, the blockchain has come to a point where there are two competing blocks to be the next block. So the mechanism to resolve that is the longest chain wins. So if this side has another block that's made after it, it's the one that wins. This side is the loser. And so the red block, those transactions go back into the pool. So not very efficient, and also part of the reason why you need to wait a while to make sure that your transaction is inside the blockchain. So like I said, with Bitcoin, that can take a while. So that's not a very efficient system. There's a lot of processing overhead that goes into these sorts of things, and so that's another reason why you don't necessarily need to have a blockchain to solve your problem. And if you are thinking about it, there are some things you need to think about. So one of the things that is often brought up with blockchain is the fact that there's a lot of power that's used to run this. So the Bitcoin system, people often talk about the amount of energy for a country the size of Poland, it would take, which is being used by all these computers which are churning away trying to win the next block. So they have the financial incentive to do that because they're given some rewards. So in Bitcoin, they're given a bit of Bitcoin. In Ethereum, they're given what's called gas. So they're given a reward and incentivized to do that. Now, the energy issue is not as bad as people think, because a lot of those mining pools are actually located near hydroelectric farms. And so the power that's being used is actually renewable in those locations. But yes, there is a lot of power that's being used. Now, it's very much like the early 90s when it came to the internet, when it comes to blockchain. So I showed you all that money that's being plowed into research and development in this space. There are people thinking about, are there more efficient ways of doing this? And it appears that there might be. So there's a company now called Algorand. Actually, I'm not sure if that's the company name, but that's definitely the name of the algorithm. It's a professor from Cornell. And what he said was, well, this blockchain thing's pretty cool, but if I was to do that from scratch, how would I do it? And the way that I can describe it to you is it's very much like wearing a sorting hat from Harry Potter. So it's called cryptographic sortition. What happens is you might have, let's say there's 22 million people involved in the blockchain. So what happens is we need like a UN Security Council of 8 people every round to go, yes, tick, that's a block. It meets the business rules, we all agree that that's correct, up it can go. We don't want to know who's next, because if you know who's next, then you can target them and try and coerce them and everything else and game the system. We don't want to know who that is, so we want it to be random. So what we use is some special maths. Everyone's wearing that sorting hat, it whispers in their ear, for the next round, you're it. So those 8 people get involved, they go, right, that's the block, and then for the next round, it's like a temporary UN Security Council. Everybody else has a chance to be involved as well. It doesn't fork. It doesn't have all this power overhead. And it seems to be quite fast. So that's something to watch at the moment. So what I'm saying is, because the technology has been operating for this, like this, for the last 10 years or so, for these particular examples, which everyone knows about, doesn't mean it's going to stay this way.
So there aren't necessarily standards, as I've said at the moment, about what the definition of this stuff is, and that's a challenge. So as we start to get the language together, that will make it easier to have these conversations about how to use this sort of stuff. But as we move forward in the next 5 or 10 years, I don't think what we refer to as blockchain today will be what we're referring to as blockchain in the future. So, see a lot of glazed eyes. Hope I haven't hit you with too much. That was a lot of information to take in a short amount of time, so I will take a breath and a glass of water. I'll let you think about a question, and if you don't, I'll start asking questions myself.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes?
I'm probably not unique in being confused between, a little between where you draw the distinction between a blockchain and what it's being used for. And the impression I get is that there are, like, a blockchain is a data structure, and there's the blockchain that does Bitcoin, and you're showing here Ethereum. But from how you explain Ethereum, it sounds like this is a blockchain that you can have multiple different applications on. Is that right?
So this was a sort of the next generation, as it were. So there was Bitcoin, where we went, we can put transactions on here and nobody can change it. That's cool. When you interact with this stuff, you're not interacting with the blockchain, you're interacting with an application, right? So there's a layer in front where you don't actually see this. It's like when you deal with a database. You don't deal with the database, you deal with the form or something on the front end. With Ethereum, they went, we can start to put executable programmatic language on here, so we can get it to think about stuff. So that's that smart contract stuff. I don't like the term, they're not smart, they're not contracts, you've not digitized 800 years of case law, you've put some sort of process and you've digitized that. And so that's often where I have to have conversations between lawyers and technologists. But what they've done is they've gone, right, what we can do is we can say, all right, we're going to digitize something, for example, that'll hold escrow, and say, yes, I've managed to verify that you've conducted your performance, and so therefore I will transact and give you the money that's owed. So that's just a simple version of what a smart contract can do, but we can put that on here now. So we can start to put executable code, essentially, into this and have smart things that happen. So it's different than the first one. Terry, did you have a follow-up?
No, yeah, I think that sort of explained it, yeah.
Okay, all right, cool. All right, I could go into more detail maybe afterwards if you want. Okay, yes?
Given how energy intensive it is to run these blockchains, what kind of level do you picture it going into for real-world applications? Like using your mango example,
yep.
Would there be the Australian mango growers and then the strawberry growers and then that, you know, asparagus growers all having their individual blockchains? Or would it be like the Australian agriculture blockchain?
Sure. Great question. So I get asked that a lot. So there won't be one blockchain to rule the world. It's like databases. It's good if you can have less of them instead of more. Yes, there's a lot of energy which is going into Ethereum and to Bitcoin, and that's because there's a financial incentive for everybody to do that proof of work mechanism. You don't need that necessarily. So particularly in the big corporates, they're not using this type of thing. They're using trusted nodes. So I might give you an example of that in just a second. What was I going to say? Oh, so one of the reasons that we put together the international standards working groups around this is because we need a way, what would be really useful, is for blockchains to reference and talk to and about each other. So at the moment, we don't necessarily have that. And so that's a challenge. And so one of the reasons why I also caution people about going into pilots is I'm like, well, if you set that up today, you might need to completely change the format of that so that can be referenced by something else or talk to something else. Or have you thought about the Archive Act and what that means as well? So there's lots of things that people need to think about in that space. Let me give you an example of a couple of countries that are using blockchain, how they're using blockchain, and why they use it in different ways, in different regions. Sorry. So Sweden is using blockchain for a few use cases. One of them is land titles. Now, being a Scandinavian country, everybody trusts them. And they go, cool, we trust you. And I usually have graphs in longer presentations that talk about where they sit in the world, about who trusts who and all that sort of stuff. And so in that case, the government processes the block because everyone goes, we trust you, go and process the block, that's fine. So they do that. It's not a disintermediation function. The government is still involved, and the same number of actors are involved. So there's, I think, 6 actors involved in that transaction. And they are getting efficiency out of it, and it's because they're a very polite society. And so when they go, oh, it's with you, they go, oh, very sorry about that, and they move along the chain. So they're getting, they're talking about integrity, and yes, they are probably defending themselves in an information operations systems way against adversaries, but they're finding efficiencies coming out of that system. Contrast that against, there's quite a few actually, African countries, particularly developing ones, where they're on a different end of the spectrum when it comes to trust in each other and trust in government. And so there they're using these proof of work mechanisms because they trust this mechanism to process, to do that thing and go, right, this is the transaction, this is the record, right? So you can't change the record. So it's on there. So they're also finding that there is efficiency in that, but fundamentally they are getting integrity in the process. Now, there are some people out there who do the rock star thing around blockchain and say, it can do everything in the world. Well, one of the examples that, some of these people have given have said, look, you know, if you're in one of these countries and the rule of law is a bit shaky and someone is holding a gun to your head, then, you know, blockchain's going to save the day. Well, if you're coerced to make a transaction at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if it's on paper or on glass, you're going to be coerced to make that transaction. But in those circumstances, what I'm saying is you can use blockchains in different ways for different reasons at the end of the day. And yes, it would be good if they could speak to each other. Any other questions? Yes.
Just a question, what if? As far as I can make out, the maths between the blockchains are sorting type problems. Now, if you can go and solve that problem quickly, say using a quantum computer, can you go and change the blockchain in the past so that you can defraud the system?
Yes. I want to give you several answers to this, but I'm mindful that I'm on camera. So... yes, there is a challenge with the fact that you might have heard of the 51% attack. So when you have a public distributed ledger and everybody's got a copy of it, if more than 51% of that network agree that this is the way that the ledger looks, then everybody else just has to come on board, right? So they go, right, we can change the past. And everyone goes, oh, well, I guess that's the truth as written. So that's a problem. There has been some research recently to suggest that you need far less than the 51% when you're talking about the mining pool. So the people are actually going in and doing the processing on the nodes to make these blocks. If you own a certain portion of that, you can start to do interesting things to the network. You can say which of these transactions go on next. Now, that could be a problem if we start to put securities and things on there, because then we can say transactions from this jurisdiction or from these companies are not getting on next, or they are getting on next. So we could do those types of things. We could also start to put other types of fraud onto the system and network as well. So whilst we have been in a situation where we've not seen any fraudulent attacks to extant blockchain, so what's there is there, and everyone's kind of happy with that. It's not to say that you're right. Someone could get a lot of processing power, particularly if they're talking about quantum, and they can start to manipulate the blockchain. So you might have heard of Mt. Gox and these other exchanges out there, and there's been these cyber attacks and people have stolen Bitcoin. That's got nothing to do with the ledger, the blockchain at all. It's got to do with the cybersecurity of that server and of that institution, because when you interact with the blockchain, you're using a key. So if somebody steals my key, then they can go to the blockchain and they can go and do whatever with my assets that are on the blockchain. So that's got to do with my cybersecurity. So before, when I was talking to you about the banks, banks have really got good cybersecurity, right? And so do I want to use their cybersecurity or do I want to use my cybersecurity to protect my assets? And so that's the question in that space. Do you have a follow-up? No?
It's okay, thank you.
Okay, sure. I'd be very happy to continue that conversation either after that stops or after this presentation if you'd like. Yes?
Curious if there's like an efficient scale at which blockchain works. Because you're talking about like global currency trading or supply chain dynamics. You can imagine some of this might be useful sort of in a household or regional context. Is there a sort of scale at which this becomes an effective technology?
An ineffective technology. So yes, people are working on that right now. So Darcy Swan is working with University of Sydney on the Red Belly blockchain, and that's all about speed, because at the moment, you might have heard around Bitcoin, the Bitcoin blocks are only 1 meg in size, and they can only do so many transactions with that, right? So there's a choke point with that.
people are talking about trying to make that larger, and there's been a lot of argument about that, and because it's a public governance model where everybody involved has to come to consensus about changing that, that's proven to be fraught and shown us a lot of issues in that space. But also, if you make those blocks larger and you start to do more transactions, you get to that bloat issue that I was talking about before. There are ways to resolve that. Maybe we can talk about that offline because it gets a bit technical. But people are looking into this, and they're changing the scale. They are dealing with the scaling issue. So yes, you can, but you need to start thinking cleverly about how much data you're storing on there and how you reference that at the end of the day. So I can talk to you about that in more detail, but maybe after this session. Yes?
Do you have any comment about using Bitcoin as a security mechanism for electronic voting?
Yes. So I spoke about this in the report. One of the things that I was mindful of is that when people record data, they're not always aware of what can be done to re-identify information. And so one of the points that I made in there was if you're going to use it for voting, you want to try and make sure that you don't link that record back to the person who made the vote, so you know which way they voted. So you need to be very careful about how you do that type of thing, so there can't be re-identification at the end of the day. So I would also be disinclined to put a democratic process onto a public blockchain, given the fact that people can change how that blockchain operates, plus of also the cybersecurity issues I was talking about as well. So if people are putting things up and they think it can't be re-identified because it's encrypted or otherwise obfuscated, maybe down the track that is not necessarily true. So I would be very hesitant about using this type of infrastructure for that type of use case. Any other questions? I could talk about some more if we turn the camera off. Is that a yes or a no?
Is the camera still on?
You want to shut down.
I think we can at this point, unless there's anything out there. There's another question.
This might be a simplistic sort of question, but to what extent is this a disruptive technology, or is it just scaling up some capabilities and, in fact, functions that people do already in terms of, you know, ledgers?
So, very good question. Some of the technology that goes into this has been around for 40 years. We started to recently smash it together, but this is interesting in the way that we're doing things. And yes, some of the use cases that people are applying this to, you can do through other means. So what happened? So around 2008, there was a price point where people went, there's all this unused bandwidth on the internet and all these computers that hang around not doing very much. What we could do is use that to support the application of these technologies together to use that proof of work mechanism. Now, is that mechanism sustainable? Don't necessarily believe so, but you've asked a very good question. I would answer in two ways. One is it starts a conversation about how do you do things better. The answer is not always necessarily blockchain. A lot of people come to us and they say, we'd like to use blockchain, and we go, why? And they go, because blockchain, and we go, well, actually, let's have a conversation here about what you're trying to achieve, and let's see what we can do in that regard. That said, there are novel applications with this technology that can do really interesting things. So I spoke before about Internet of Things and the devices. With a device, the really important thing around cybersecurity is the configuration of that device. So the one thing that a hacker will probably try and do when they come in is change that configuration to increase their privileges or to get the device to do something that it wasn't meant to do or whatever else. And these devices are now everywhere. I normally have a slide up that talks about vehicles. And I talk about driverless cars and how important it will be to have security around all of the Internet of Things devices in the driverless cars. People go, yep, that makes sense. And then I go, well, here's some examples of 2 or 3, 4 years ago where vehicles on the road today have been demonstrated to have vulnerabilities and people have hacked them. And they have taken control of the steering wheel at highway speeds and applied the brakes and done all these sorts of things. And they've come in through vulnerabilities in the entertainment system because that was where the wireless access was and it actually was connected to the control system and it shouldn't have been, but it was. So there are vulnerabilities today in that space. I have been surprised because I often speak to people about what they're doing with blockchain, and I've been surprised that this hasn't been commercialized just yet. So I know there's some people sort of holding fire on that type of thing, but you can use blockchain to go, right,
here's the configuration, or actually here's a thumbprint of the configuration. You have to store the whole thing. You can actually store what's called a hash, which is literally a thumbprint of that, and go every few seconds if you want. Does that thumbprint match the thumbprint of the configuration? Oh, it doesn't. Oh, okay. Is someone hacking it? Is there an accident? Is it misconfigured? What's going on? So the health of these networks of devices, you can start to check that. The other thing that you can do is start to check the input parameters that come in. So some of the other things that I speak to people about are the fact that advanced manufacturing is really changing. And I often show people when they go, cyber-physical systems, what are you talking about? That's still computers. And I go, well, let's look at things like there's a thing called SCADA, supervisory control and data acquisition, and it's a type of network which lives in an engineering environment, and it's a trusted environment. So people don't necessarily think about security, and that's what happened with the internet too. People built the internet, and it was done for defense back in the Cold War days, and they're like, if we lose a node, node being the city, how do we get the information around to keep doing what we need to do? And that was the whole premise of the architecture. They weren't thinking about integrity. They were thinking about availability. They weren't necessarily thinking about confidentiality because it was a trusted environment. And then it slowly creeped into the research and academia fields, and then everybody got on and we went, we need to bolt on security to that. So we have these networks, pardon me, and devices, and people starting to plug them into the internet because they can, and it gives them utility and functionality. And there's a case, 2016, I think, from memory, where there was a steel mill in Germany, and someone got into it because someone had connected that engineering network into the internet, and someone caused millions of dollars worth of damage by tipping over molten steel onto the floor. So there's vulnerabilities there. So that's industrial stuff. I used to be an information security manager 10 years ago, and the same types of issues which are around then are very much around now. So people are going, it's all right, we'll just get on to that. Well, we need to do things to make sure that people get on to that, particularly when we start to think about things like the Internet of Things and Industry 4.0. And that's not just a crazy plastic printer on your desk. That is now a sintering device which is spraying molten titanium at a, you know, at a mold to build a an exact bespoke biomedical device, or like an implantable jaw or joint or something like that, right? So I used to make jokes 10 years ago about internet-connected fridges. I'm one of those. What's that all about? Well, most of the food chains have them these days. The blood banks have them as well, right? So they want to know, is my stock okay? We think about things like the crypto lockers. I can't think of their name. The you know, when you go in and you can't get access to your computer anymore, it's been encrypted, and they want you to pay in Bitcoin to unlock it. Right. So that's a nuisance. What happens when it's a very hot summer and someone comes along and they say, "Pay up, or we're going to turn off your fridges overnight"? That's a big deal, right? So you want to make sure that these things have their configuration locked down, but also the information that you're sending to them, the commands, similar deal, logistical supply chains in Australia are a challenge, right? So lots of fuel is used, lots of time and energy to move stuff around. It's great if we can do just in time. Can I build it here cheaper or at the same cost as trying to ship it in from over the other side of the world? So I often get car parts in from America because I have to, and it can take 6-8 weeks, sometimes longer, and it's not necessarily what I want. If I could build something here and it was a better version and it was done quicker, sure, I'd pay a premium for that. But now we've got these devices which are possibly going to move into small to medium enterprises, right? So it's not no longer a big factory with yellow lines on the floor and personal protective equipment and all these sorts of safety hazard material. Now we're dealing with people in the back room with a device which is essentially a flamethrower, and someone can feed some information to that which could be incorrect and cause it to do a bad thing, right? Explode, noxious fumes, whatever. So we start to talk about real-world applications or implications of these sorts of things. So if I have an input to it, like a design, and I know that that design is verified because it's come from a supplier and that is a thumbprint of that is on their ledger. So a hash is a representation of any information asset, but it's a one-way thing. So I can take my thumbprint, put it on this table. You can know that it was me that left it, but you can't work out and recreate me from that thumbprint. Hash is the same deal. I can take the Game of Thrones, turn that into a hash. It's a series of letters and numbers that represent that book of Game of Thrones. I move a comma, choose one in there, move it to the right. I get a completely different set of letters and numbers at the end of the day. It looks completely different. So, but it's a unique representation of this information asset. So you can put that hash out there and say, here's the hash of that blueprint that I'm going to give you, and you're not going to disclose your IP. but we can use that for integrity, so when you feed that into your 3D printer, your flamethrower, whatever, we know that, yes, that is the correct one that goes into there. So, yes, there are issues but with the emerging Industry 4.0, but blockchain could potentially solve issues in novel ways that that we don't necessarily currently have solutions for. That was a long-winded answer.
Well, I think that's really good, because I think you've talked about configuration of devices, which is sort of a new thing because devices now need to be configured. We've also talked about supply chains and logistics and record keeping and records of transactions like the land titles one. So all of those are sort of old school kind of things, except for devices. But, I mean, it's all about a layer of checking or authenticity that you can provide for those transactions and functions that you're previously doing. I mean, logistics and record keeping of transactions, that's like fundamental to society.
Mm-hmm.
And the configuring devices, that's newer, but the function of the blockchain in each of those examples is to provide an extra, you know, as you say, thumbprint kind of layer of authenticity or checking. So I guess it's reinforcing things that we do already, but in terms of doing something new, you know, I'm not criticising anything, I'm just saying that my observation is you didn't actually mention any sort of novel things that really kind of stood out to me. So I'm concluding that blockchain is useful for retrofitting to make things better that we do already.
Yes. Yes, it can be, but you need to weigh it up, the pros and the cons. So I'm mindful of time.
Yes, we might end the formal proceedings here, if that's okay.
Certainly.
And I'll thank you very much for that talk. And if you join me in thanking Rob. And I hope your assets don't dematerialise. Thank you. And those of you who have other questions, when the camera is switched off, you may be able to get further detail from Rob in certain very interesting areas. So feel free to continue the discussion. Thank you.